This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This recording is by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The First Battle of Bull Run, taken from Battles and Leaders of the Civil War, Volume 1, written by General P.G.T. Beauregard, the commander of the victorious Southern side in the battle. This section is entitled Subsequent Relations of Mr. Davis and the Writer. The military result of the victory was far short of what it should have been. It established as an accomplished fact, on the indispensable basis of military success, the government of the Confederate States, which before was but a political assertion, but it should have reached much further. The immediate pursuit, but for the false alarm which checked it, would have continued as far as the Potomac, but must have stopped there with no greater result than the capture of more prisoners and material. The true immediate fruits of the victory should have been the dispersion of all the Federal forces south of Baltimore and east of the Alleghenies, the liberation of the state of Maryland, and the capture of Washington, which could have been made only by the upper Potomac. And from the high source of this achievement, other decisive results would have continued to flow. From my experience in the Mexican War, I had great confidence in intelligent volunteer troops, if rightly handled. And with such an active and victorious war engine as the Confederate Army of the Potomac could have immediately been made, reinforced as time went by numbers and discipline, the Federal military power in the East could never have reached the head it took when McClellan was allowed to reorganize and discipline at leisure the powerful army that, in the end, wore out the South. In war, one success makes another easier, and its right use is as the step to another until final achievement. This was the use besought by me in the plan of campaign I have mentioned, as presented to Mr. Davis on the 14th of July, a few days before the battle, but rejected by him as impracticable, and rather offering opportunity to the enemy to crush us. To supply the deficiency of transportation, our vehicles being few in number, and many so poor as to break down an ordinary camp service, I myself had assigned to special duty Colonel, since Governor, James L. Kemper of Virginia, who quickly obtained for me some 200 good wagons, to which number I had limited him so as not to arouse again the jealousy of the President's staff. If my plan of operations for the capture of Washington had been adopted, I should have considered myself thereby authorized and free to obtain, as I readily could have done, the transportation necessary. As it was, though the difficult part of this impracticable plan of operations had been proven feasible, that is, the concentration of the Shenandoah forces with mine, rung later than the 11th hour through the alarm over the march upon Richmond, and discountenanced again nervously at the 12th hour by another alarm as to how, quote, the enemy may vary his plans, end quote, in consequence, followed by the decisive defeat of the main Federal forces. Nevertheless, the army remained rooted in the spot, although we had more than 15,000 troops who had been not at all or but little in the battle and were perfectly organized, while the remaining commands, in the high spirits of victory, could have been reorganized at the tap of the drum, and many with improved captured arms and equipments. I had already urged my views with unusual persistency, and acted on them against all but an express order to the contrary. And as they had been deliberately rejected in their ultimate scope by Mr. Davis as the commander-in-chief, I did not feel authorized to urge them further than their execution had been allowed, unless the subject were broached anew by himself. But there was no intimation of any such change of purpose, and the army, consistently with this inertia, was left unprovided for maneuver with transportation for its ammunition. Its fortitude, moreover, as a new and volunteer army, while spending sometimes 24 hours without food, being only less wonderful than the commissary administration at Richmond, from which such a state of affairs could proceed even 2 weeks after the Battle of Manassas. Although certain political superstitions about not consolidating the North may then have weighed against the action I proposed, they would have been light against true military policy if such had existed at the head of the government. Apart from an active material ally, such as the colonies had afield and on sea in the War of Independence with Great Britain, a country in fatal war must depend on the vigor of its warfare. The more inferior the country, the bolder and more enterprising the use of its resources, especially if its frontiers are convenient to the enemy. I was convinced that our success lay in a short, quick war of decisive blows, before the Federals, with their vast resources, could build up a great military power, to which end a concerted use of our forces, immediate and sustained, was necessary, so that, weaker though we were at all separate points, we might nevertheless strike with superior strength at some chosen decisive point, and after victory there, reach for victory now made easier elsewhere, and thus sum up success. Instead of this, which in war we call concentration, our actual policy was diffusion, an inferior Confederate force at each separate point, defensively confronting a superior Federal force, our power daily shrinking, that of the enemy increasing, the avowed Federal policy being that of attrition, their bigger masses grinding our smaller, one by one, to naught. Out of this state we never emerged. When the direction of the government was, as almost always, necessary, excepting when Richmond was immediately in danger. Thus, in the fall of 1861, about 3 months after the Battle of Manassas, after throwing my whole force forward to Fairfax Courthouse, with outposts flaunting our flags on the hills in sight of Washington, in order to chafe the Federals to another battle, but without success, I proposed that the army should be raised to an effective of 60,000 men, by drawing 20,000 for the immediate enterprise from several points along the seaboard, not even at that time threatened, and from our advanced position be swiftly thrown across the Potomac at a point which I had had carefully surveyed for that purpose, and moved upon the rear of Washington, thus forcing McClellan to a decisive engagement before his organization, new enlistments, was completed. And while our own army had the advantage of discipline and prestige, seasoned soldiers, whose term, however, would expire in the early part of the coming summer. This plan, approved by General Gustavus W. Smith, then immediately commanding General Johnston's own forces, as well as by General Johnston, was submitted to Mr. Davis in a conference at my headquarters, but rejected because he would not venture to strip those points of the troops we required. Even if those points had been captured, though none were then even threatened, they must have reverted as a direct consequence to so decisive a success. I was willing then, should it have come to that, to exchange even Richmond temporarily for Washington. Yet it was precisely from similar combinations and elements that the army was made up, to enable it the next spring, under General Lee, to encounter McClellan at the very door of Richmond. If that which was accepted as a last defensive resort against an overwhelming aggressive army had been used as an enterprising offensive against that same army while yet in the raw, the same venture had been made at less general risk, less cost of valuable lives, and with greater certain results. The Federal army would have had no chance meanwhile to become tempered to that magnificent military machine which, through all its defeats and losses, remained sound and was stronger, with its readily assimilating new strength, at the end of the war than ever before. The pressure would have been lifted from Kentucky and Missouri, and we should have maintained what is called an active defensive warfare, that is, should have taken and kept the offensive against the enemy, enforcing peace. No people ever warred for independence with more relative advantages than the Confederates, and if, as a military question, they must have failed, then no country must aim at freedom by means of war. We were one in sentiment as in territory, starting out, not with a struggling administration of doubtful authority, but with our ancient state governments and a fully organized central government. As a military question, it was in no sense a civil war, but a war between two countries, for conquest on one side, for self-preservation on the other. The South, with its great material resources, its defensive means of mountains, rivers, railroads, and telegraph, with the immense advantage of the interior lines of war, would be open to discredit as a people if its failure could not be explained otherwise than by mere industrial contrast. The great Frederick, at the head of a little people, not only beat back a combination of several great military powers, but conquered and kept territory. And Napoleon held combined Europe at the feet of France till his blind ambition overleaped itself. It may be said that the South had no Fredericks or Napoleons, but it had at least as good commanders as its adversary. Nor was it the fault of our soldiers or people. Our soldiers were as brave and intelligent as ever bore arms, and if only for reasons already mentioned, they did not lack in determination. Our people bore a devotion to the cause never surpassed, and which no war-making monarch ever had for his support. They gave their all, even the last striplings under the family roofs filling the ranks voided by the fall of their fathers and brothers. But the narrow military view of the head of the government, which illustrated itself at the outset by ordering from Europe not 100,000 or 1,000,000, but 10,000 stands of arms, as an increase upon 8,000 its first estimate, was equally narrow and timid in its employment of our armies. The moral and material forces actually engaged in the war made our success a moral certainty, but for the timid policy which, ignoring strategy as a science, and boldness of enterprise as its ally, could never be brought to view the whole theater of war as one subject, of which all points were but integral parts, or to hazard for the time points relatively unimportant, for the purpose of gathering for an overwhelming and rapid stroke at some decisive point, and which again, with characteristic miselation, would push a victorious force directly forward into unsupported and disastrous operations, instead of using its victory to spare from it strength sufficient to secure an equally important success in another quarter. The great principles of war are truths, and the same today as in the time of Caesar or Napoleon. Notwithstanding the ideas of some thoughtless persons, their applications being but intensified by the scientific discoveries affecting transportation and communication of intelligence. These principles are few and simple, however various their deductions and application. Skill and strategy consist in seeing through the intricacies of the whole situation, and bringing into proper combination forces and influences, though seemingly unrelated, so as to supply these principles, and with boldness of decision and execution, appearing with the utmost force, and if possible, superior odds, before the enemy at some strategic, that is, decisive point. And although a sound military plan may not always be so readily conceived, yet any plan that offers decisive results, if it agree with the principles of war, is as plain and intelligible as these principles themselves, and no more to be rejected than they. There still remains, of course, the hazard of accident in execution, and the apprehension of the enemy's movements upsetting your own. But hazard may also favor as well as disfavor, and will not unbefriend the enterprising any more than the timid. It was this fear of possible consequences that kept our forces scattered in inferior relative strength at all points of the compass, each holding its bit of ground till by slow local process our territory was taken and our separate forces destroyed, or, if captured, retained by the enemy without exchange in their process of attrition. To stop the slow consumption of this passive mode of warfare, I tried my part, and at certain critical junctures, proposed to the government active plans of operation looking to such results as I have described. Sometimes, it is true, in relation to the employment of forces not under my control, as I was the soldier of a cause and people, not of a monarch nor even of a government. Two occasions there were when certain of the most noted federal operations, from their isolated or opportune character, might, with energy and intelligent venture on the Confederate side, have been turned into fatal disaster. Among them, Grant's movement in front of Vicksburg, and his change of base from the north to the south of the James River, where I was in command in his last campaign against Richmond. I urged particularly that our warfare was sure of final defeat unless we attempted decisive strokes that might be followed up to the end, and that, even if earlier defeat might chance from the risk involved in the execution of the necessary combinations, we ought to take that risk, and thereby either win or end an otherwise useless struggle. But, in addition to the radical divergence of military ideas, the passive defensive of an intellect timid of risk and not at home in war, and the active defensive reaching for success through enterprise and boldness, according to the lessons taught us in the campaigns of the great masters, there was a personal feeling that now gave cold hearing, or none, to any recommendations of mine. Mr. Davis's friendship, warm at the early period of the war, was changed, sometime after the Battle of Manassas, to a corresponding hostility from several personal causes, direct and indirect, of which I need mention but one. My report of Manassas having contained, as part of its history, a statement of the submission of the full plan of campaign for concentrating our forces, crushing successfully McDowell and Patterson, and capturing Washington, Mr. Davis strangely took offense thereat, and now that events have demonstrated the practicability of that plan, he sought to get rid of his self-accused responsibility for rejecting it, by denying that any such had been submitted, an issue, for that matter, easily settled by my production of the contemporaneous report of Colonel James Chesnut, the bearer of the mission, who, moreover, at the time of this controversy was on Mr. Davis's own staff, where he remained. Mr. Davis made an endeavor to suppress the publication of my report of the Battle of Manassas. The matter came up in a secret debate in the Confederate Congress, where a host of friends were ready to sustain me, but I sent a telegram disclaiming any desire for its publication, and advising that the safety of the country should be our solicitude, and not personal ends. Thenceforth Mr. Davis's hostility was watchful and adroit, neglecting no opportunity, great or small, and though from motives all its opposite, it was not exposed during the war by any murmurs of mine, it bruited sometimes in certain quarters of its own force. Thus, when in January 1862, the Western representatives expressed a desire that I should separate myself for a time from my Virginia forces and go to the defense of the Mississippi Valley from the impending offensive of Halleck and Grant, it was furthered by the executive with inducements which I trusted, in disregard of Senator Toombs' sagacious warning that under this furtherance lurked a purpose to effect my downfall, urged in one of his communications through his son-in-law, Mr. Alexander, in words as impressive as they prove prophetic. Quote, "Urge General Beauregard to decline all proposals as solicitations. The blade of Joab, verbum sapienti." End quote. After going through the campaign of Shiloh and Corinth, not only with those inducements unfulfilled, but with vital drawbacks from the government, including the refusal of necessary rank to competent subordinates to assist in organizing my hastily collected and mostly raw troops, I was forced, the following June, in deferred obedience to the positive order of my physicians, to withdraw from my immediate camp to another point in my department for recovery from illness, leaving under the care of my lieutenant, General Bragg, my army, then unmenaced and under reorganization with a view to an immediate offensive I had proposed. In anticipation and exclusion of the receipt of full dispatches following my telegram, the latter was tortuously misread, in a manner not creditable to a schoolboy, and repugnant to Mr. Davis's exact knowledge of syntax, so as to give pretext to this shocking charge that I had abandoned my army. And a telegram was sent in naked haste directly to General Bragg, telling him to retain the permanent command of the army. The blade of Joab had given its thrust. The representatives in Congress from the West and Southwest applied to Mr. Davis in a body for my restoration. And when, disregarding his sheer pretext that I had abandoned my army, they still insisted, Mr. Davis declared that I should not be restored if the whole world should ask it. This machination went to such length that it was given out in Richmond that I had softening of the brain and gone crazy. So carefully was this report fostered, one of its tales being that I would sit all day stroking a pheasant. Footnote. This silly tale was borrowed from an incident of Shiloh. Toward the end of the first day's battle, a soldier had found a pheasant cowering, apparently paralyzed under the ceaseless din, and brought it to my headquarters as a present to me. It was a beautiful bird, and I gave directions to place it in a cage, as I intended sending it as a pleasant token of the battle to the family of Judge Milton Brown, of Jackson, Tennessee, from whom I had received as their guest, while occupying that place, the kindest attentions. But in the second day's conflict the poor waif was lost. End of footnote. A friend of mine, a member of the Confederate Congress, thought it his duty to write me a special letter respecting the device, advising me to come directly to Richmond to confound it by my presence, a proceeding which I disdained to take. I had not only then, but from later, still more offensive provocation, imperative cause to resign, and would have done so but for a sense of public obligation. Indeed, in my after fields of action, the same hostility was more and more active in its various embarrassments, reckless that the strains inflicted upon me bore upon the troops and country depending on me, and relatively upon the cause, so that I often dreaded failure more than my own government behind me, than from the enemy in my front. And when success came in spite of this, it was acknowledged only by some censorious official inquiry contrasting with the repeated thanks of the Congress. I was, however, not the only one of the highest military rank with whom Mr. Davis's relations were habitually unwholesome. It is an extraordinary fact that during the 4 years of war, Mr. Davis did not call together the five generals with a view to determining the best military policy, or settling upon a decisive plan of operations involving the whole theater of war, though there was often ample opportunity for it. We needed for president either a military man of a high order, or a politician of the first class without military pretensions, such as Howell Cobb. The South did not fall crushed by the mere weight of the North, but it was nibbled away at all sides and ends, because its executive head never gathered and wielded its great strength under the ready advantages greatly reduced or neutralized its adversary's naked physical superiority. It is but another of the many proofs that timid direction may readily go with physical courage, and that the passive defensive policy may make a long agony, but can never win a war. Postscript. Since the publication of the foregoing pages in The Century for November 1884, General J. E. Johnston, in the course of a paper also contributed to The Century, took occasion for the first time to set up with positiveness and circumstantiality the claim to having exercised a controlling connection with the tactics of all phases of the Battle of the 21st of July, 1861. Respecting such a pretension, I shall be content for the present to recall that, while entirely at variance with the part I have ascribed to him in relation to that field, it is logically untenable at this day when confronted with the records of the period. In my own official report of the battle, closely contemporaneous with the events narrated, a report that was placed in his hands for perusal before transmission, it is distinctly related that for certain reasons, chiefly military, General Johnston had left in my hands for the impending conflict the command of the Confederate forces. The precise circumstances of my direct conduct of and responsibility for the battle are stated in such terms that, Had I not been in actual direction of the day's operations on the part of the Confederates, General Johnston must have made the issue squarely then and there in his own official report. And all the more incumbent upon him was the making of such an issue, it seems to me, then or never, in view of the fact that the Confederate Secretary of War, on the 24th of July, 1861, wrote me in these words, quote, "My dear General, accept my congratulations for the glorious and most brilliant victory achieved by you. The country will bless and honor you for it. Believe me, dear General, truly your friend, L.P. Walker." End quote. Further, General Lee thus addressed me, quote, "My dear General, I cannot express the joy I feel at the brilliant victory of the 21st. The skill, courage, and endurance displayed by yourself excite my highest admiration. You and your troops have the gratitude of the whole country, and I offer to all my heartfelt congratulations at their success. Very truly yours, R. E. Lee." End quote. Of the exact purport of these two letters, General Johnston could not have been ignorant when he wrote his report of the battle. Nor could he have been unaware that the leading Southern newspapers had in effect attributed to me the chief direction of that battle on the Confederate side. Therefore, if it were the gross historical error which, 20 years after the affair, General Johnston characterizes it to be, and one that imputed to him the shirking of a duty which he could not have left unassumed without personal baseness, certainly that was the time for him, by a few explicit words in his official report, to dispose of so affronting an error. In that report, however, no such exigent, peremptory statement of his relation to the battle is to be found. On the other hand, upon page 57 of his narrative, published in 1874, may be found, I fear, the clue to the motive of his actual waiver of command in this curious paragraph, quote, "If the tactics of the Federals had been equal to their strategy, we should have been beaten. If, instead of being brought into action in detail, their troops had been formed in two lines, with a proper reserve, and had assailed Bee and Jackson in that order, the two Southern brigades must have been swept from the field in a few minutes, or enveloped. General McDowell would have made such a formation, probably, had he not greatly underestimated the strength of his enemy." End quote. Coupled with the disquieting, ever-apprehensive tenor of his whole correspondence with the Confederate War Department, from the day he assumed command in the Valley of Virginia in May 1861, down to the close of the struggle in 1865, the fair inference from such language as that just cited from his narrative is that General Johnston came to Manassas beset with the idea that our united forces would not be able to cope with the Federal Army, and that we should be beaten, a catastrophe in which he was not solicitous to figure on the pages of history as the leading and responsible actor. Originally, and until 1875, I had regarded it as a generous though natural act on the part of General Johnston, in such a juncture, to leave me in command and responsible for what might occur. The history of military operations abounds in instances of notable soldiers who have found it proper to waive chief command under similar conditions. End of the report.